Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The benefit of collecting DNA evidence in the immediate aftermath of a rape and storing it safely is undisputed. But for years in Ohio, thousands of rape kits sat untested in police departments and crime lab storage facilities across the state. The same neglect occurred across the country, affecting hundreds of thousands of sexual assault cases. Ohio has since caught up. This hour, we'll talk about how the state changed the process and its priorities. Cleveland Plain Dealer reporter Rachel DeSalle has spent the last 7 years investigating forgotten rape kits in Ohio. Her investigations led to a new law mandating that old and new rape kits be tested. Rachel joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on today.
You know, let's start with a description of what we mean by a rape kit and what that process is. It's a lot more complicated than I ever really understood before. What happens?
Sure. So often someone who has been the victim of a sexual assault will go to a hospital or a medical center. And there's two important reasons for that. The first being so that someone can get the appropriate medical care, you know, treat any injuries they have, get possible treatment to prevent them from getting STDs or pregnancy, and also to collect evidence. And so as any sexual assault nurse who's trained will let you know, it's a really long process and it's really involved, but the person who's there has a choice at each step. So they ask a person at each step, is it okay if I do this step? Is it okay if I do this step? Those steps can include collecting forensic or biological evidence from any site on the victim's body that it could have been left behind. So anything from fingernails to, you know, to genital areas to, you know, if someone kissed and maybe left saliva behind, you know, collecting semen. And so it's, you know, it's not a process that someone is going to elect to go through, you know, if there's not a reason for it. And a lot of times what people are told is that, you know, that process does really help law enforcement do some of its investigation. So making a decision about whether you want to prosecute at that point isn't really necessary, but it's really the only time that evidence can be collected and preserved.
Are you going to have that same process available to you if you go directly to the police?
The police officers do not do that. That needs to be done by medical professionals who have training in collecting that evidence. Now, police officers can go to the scene of a crime and collect different type of evidence there, you know, from a car or from bed sheets or things like that. But it's really trained personnel that need to do that kind of collection and also make sure that someone's medical needs are taken care of.
So if I go to a hospital, they put me through the process to assemble the rape kit. Do they also have to inform police at that time?
You know, there has to be kind of a mandatory report that a rape has occurred, but it is up to a victim as to whether they want to speak to police or make kind of a formal criminal report about that. You can go to a hospital and go through that process and not make a report if you don't want to or if you're not ready to, or you can go back and make that report at a later date.
And if you go to a police department, are they going to say, okay, you can make your report, but now you need to go to a hospital?
I think they would encourage people to go to a hospital and get a rape kit if the offense that happened was within the last maybe 72 hours or
right.
So. It's really specific in terms of what can be collected within a certain time period. So I think at a lot of police departments, if you were to walk in, they would encourage you to go and also to get that treatment, you know, for your medical needs if you were assaulted. But I think a lot of that also depends on the type of assault that it was and when it occurred. A lot of people report assaults, you know, a week or two after they happen because it's such a traumatic episode that they literally cannot do it at that moment. So each situation is different.
You first began asking questions about rape kits in late 2009 when 11 bodies were discovered in and around the Cleveland home of Anthony Soul, a convicted rapist. Tell us about what triggered your interest in that case.
You know, after that case, myself and another reporter, Layla Atassi, were asked to really look at all aspects of sex crimes investigations in Cleveland. You know, we were looking at how victims were treated when they reported, how they were interviewed, what kind of language was used in reports. You know, not often the nicest language sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, was there a bias against victims? And this was just one thing that we decided to ask about. So part of what reporters often do is we put in public records requests. We ask for a lot of things, and we hope that we get them. What kind of got our attention on this is when we asked Cleveland Police about rape evidence, you know, how many rape kits they collected and how many of those were tested, there really wasn't a clear answer right away. They basically said, well, we don't know. We have, you know, these kits going back years. We don't know how many of them have been tested and how many have not been tested. So that was pretty striking to us. And, you know, as we learned, it was a lot more complicated than that, the reasons behind the fact that kits were or weren't tested. But we decided to kind of keep asking about it and stick with it until there was some concrete numbers available to us so that we could see which kits were being tested, which kits weren't, and what the effect of that was.
Yeah, how did that become relevant in the Sowell case?
You know, it was relevant to one of the women, at least, who had reported against Anthony Sowell in a suburb. Her kit was not fully tested and then, you know, wasn't linked to him until well after he had been arrested, even though she made a report. There were also some other issues with DNA. A lot of DNA of criminals like Anthony Sowell, who were convicted sex offenders, weren't ending up in the public crime databases that can solve those crimes. So we found a number of different issues with the system that we felt really deserved attention, and not just a short-term attention of just telling people about it, but really keeping up with it to see what happened.
When you started working on the story about rape kits, you found out that there were thousands of unopened, never investigated rape kits sitting around. Why weren't they investigated when they said, we really don't know? What was their explanation for why they wouldn't know what was being done with these kits?
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that the rape kits weren't maybe investigated. Mm-hmm. Some of the cases did have some investigation, and in fact, some cases were prosecuted. Some had very, very little investigation. And so at that point, when we started to know about numbers, when we started to know there were 4,000 or so kits in Cleveland and about, you know, maybe 5,000 total in Cuyahoga County that had not been sent for testing, you know, the next step of what we had to do was ask why about that. And in some of those cases, it was because there was very little investigation altogether. In other cases,
you mean altogether on rapes in general?
Just some of those rapes, the reports that we got were less than a page long. They were three or four sentences. Mm-hmm. And in other cases, there was more of an investigation, but at the time, officers didn't think they needed to test a kit because maybe the suspect in the case was someone that the victim knew and they had the name in the report. And I can understand why at the time people may have thought that. Mm-hmm. Now, with so much testing having been done and research being done on that, what we've learned is that the more of those kits that are tested, the more of that DNA goes in the system, you're more likely to make connections that you wouldn't have made just during one single investigation. You know, somebody who is accused of raping an acquaintance after a date might also be linked to a stranger rape that you would not have otherwise linked them to. So it really, once that testing began, highlighted the importance of getting all that evidence in there so that it could help you as an investigative tool later rather than only being viewed as something that might help you if you were going to prosecute someone.
Right. All things being equal, rapists rarely strike once. Your reporting has helped convict more than 100 rapists, some of whom were serial rapists. And one stunning finding is that as many as a third of reported rapes were perpetrated by a serial offender.
Yeah, I think that we were actually very shocked when we reported on the first 100 indictments, and now in Cleveland there's been close to 600 indictments. And now I think currently it's definitely more than 200 convictions. You know, they kind of keep coming. One of the things that we noticed was that many of the people not only had been accused of raping more than one person whose kit was tested, but also had been responsible for rapes maybe before that report was made and some after. So, you know, in theory, some of those sexual assaults could have been prevented had those pieces of the puzzle been put together. We've had folks that have been indicted here in Cuyahoga County that have been accused of raping as many as 17 women.
Rachel DeSalle, your investigation for the Cleveland Plain Dealer led to a new law in Ohio. Tell us about the law and what the impact's been.
You know, I think that the work that we did, as well as the work that the law enforcement and researchers and that was being done at the Attorney General's office, kind of all together, it kind of inspired lawmakers to do something about it. And there was a big debate because, you know, some will say that you really shouldn't test all kits. And that there should be some victim choice in that, and there's a lot to think about there. And other people say, listen, if we don't mandate it, then it won't happen. So I think what that's led to so far is, you know, close to 14,000 kits have been submitted in the state of Ohio, and these are kits that were older that had not been processed. They weren't kind of currently reported kits from when the law started. They were going back often decades in cities. They were sent by departments that had held on to those kits. So to their credit, they didn't get rid of that evidence. They kept it. And many of them submitted it. I think what we really need to know now is what is happening in all those cases. You know, we've kept pretty close track in Cleveland of all of the cases that have been submitted and how many have been indicted and thousands that are being investigated. What we don't know is that, you know, there's 9,000 or more kits submitted around the rest of Ohio. And I think it's really important to find out how many of those kits were not only tested, but how many of them were follow-up investigations. That's hard to do because that's probably 200 police jurisdictions. So the Plain Dealer is working on a plan to kind of fan out across the state and hopefully get some citizens to help us gather that information so we can get a fuller picture and then also inform lawmakers about what happened with their law that was passed, because they did mandate that people send the kits in. There's no repercussions if they don't, but what wasn't mandated is that there are follow-up investigations.
How much does it cost? I mean, was cost a factor in processing the rape kits? Did you learn that in your investigation or not?
I think in the past, you know, cost was a factor. You know, DNA testing wasn't even a regular thing in crimes in Ohio until maybe 1998, 1999. People started to learn more about it, and that's when the state crime lab kind of connected, I think, with CODIS and got its own DNA databases, so they could actually test the evidence and put the DNA profiles into these kind of searchable databases that are in each state and then connected nationwide. So some of the rapes happened before that, but there was never really a thought to go back and enter all of that older evidence in rapes or, frankly, even in all homicides that were older than that. You know, we've had homicides solved, you know, through entering DNA as well. So I think that was part of it. And the cost early on was more expensive. It was probably about $1,200 to do some of the forensic testing on a kit, and it was a multi-step process. Once the Ohio Attorney General's office committed to testing all the kits here in Ohio, people that worked in that lab kind of streamlined that process and were able to not only use machines to help make the testing easier, you know, robots that would actually be able to do multiple parts of the step kind of at once. And I'm sorry, I'm simplifying that for the very intelligent lab people, but they were able to simplify that, and they were also able to cut out some steps along the way to make it far cheaper. And I think someone can correct me if I'm not exactly right, but I think Ohio's gotten it down to around, you know, close to $400, right in that range for testing each kit. And part of what's been done in the research around the rape kits thing is showing the cost that you actually save when you test this kit and when you solve crime. So far more money is saved than what is spent, even if you count the cost to test the kit and the cost to investigate.
My guest is Rachel DeSalle. She's a reporter for the Cleveland Plain Dealer and has spent the last 7 years investigating overlooked rape kit processing procedures in Ohio. She'll stay with us, and then we'll bring somebody in from the Attorney General's office coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The benefit of collecting DNA evidence in the immediate aftermath of a rape and storing it safely is undisputed. But for years in Ohio, thousands of rape kits sat untested in police departments and crime lab storage facilities across the state. The same neglect occurred across the country, affecting hundreds of thousands of sexual assault cases. We're talking about how Ohio has made strides toward ending its rape kit backlog. Still with us is Cleveland Plain Dealer reporter Rachel DeSell. She's been reporting on the backlog in Ohio since 2009. Joining us is aftercare advocacy and outreach coordinator at the Sexual Assault Response Network of Central Ohio at Ohio Health, Anna Thompson. Welcome to the show, Anna.
Thank you.
And supervisor in the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation Laboratory, Kristen Slaper. She has been involved in thousands of DNA cases and is a member of the Ohio Attorney General's Sexual Assault Response Training Team. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Kristen, after a person has been raped or sexually assaulted, they have a 72-hour window to complete a sexual assault examination kit. Why does time matter? Why? What's the magic in 72 hours?
Time matters because we know that DNA evidence degrades over time on someone's body or inside of someone's body. So depending on the assault that occurred and the DNA evidence that may or may not be left there, you know, things like bathing, showering, changing clothes can affect what kind of evidence is going to be present when a kit is collected at the hospital.
So if DNA evidence can degrade, how are rape kits that have been left sitting on a shelf for 20 odd years protect it?
That's a very good question. The DNA is still collected at the time that the assault occurred. But in many of these cases that we have tested, there is some degradation that has gone on. So it was collected on the swabs that are inside of the kit. But there have been some challenges presented in testing some of that evidence.
What about the kit protects the evidence? Is it just a box? I mean, what does it look like?
Yes, it's a white box with envelopes and swabs. And for years in Ohio, testing a kit and collecting a kit was not mandated in any way and wasn't regulated. And since probably the early 2000s, it's been regulated as far as what's actually in the kit. There are multiple groups that have gone into, weighed in on what should be inside of a kit. So orifice swabs, slides that are made from those swabs, the collection of the person's underwear, fingernail scrapings, and any other clothing or anything else that's pertinent from that body that same nurse is listening to during their examination in order to collect.
And same nurses, that SANE is short for sexual assault nurse examiners.
Yes.
Anna Thompson, as far as getting the rape kit put together, again, you know, I've known about these kits for years and years and years, but I didn't know how complicated it was and how long the process would take. So somebody within 72 hours of being sexually assaulted has to undergo this procedure. How long does it usually take?
It really depends
on how much you agree to do.
Right. So it depends on what the victim, how far they want to go. But generally, it can take 3 to 5 hours.
Wow.
Because we have to call the same nurse to come to the hospital. It is a long process because they are picking over every part of your body. And the nurses are especially trained to ask certain questions about the assault and what took place. So they know what body parts to look at specifically to, you know, make sure they swab and get that evidence.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the process by which evidence is collected in the state of Ohio now and then analyzed for prosecution or to determine, you know, a suspect in the first place. If you have a question or comment, if you've experienced the process of the rape kit assembly, give us a call. I know it's personal and I know it might be difficult to talk about, but it might help other people, too, to understand the process. The number is 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page and post your question or your comment there. Rachel DeSell, what was your understanding about the appearance, what the rape kits looked like 20-odd years later after a lot of these things have been sitting on the shelf? Were they messed up? Were a lot of them destroyed?
No, not that I've known so far. I mean, of course, most of what I know is from the Cleveland Police Department, and you know, they have giant evidence rooms and shelves. And I think the biggest challenge for them was finding and assembling and counting these boxes. You know, and if you've ever had like one of those small personal pizzas, it's a box kind of that size. But you know, as was mentioned, they changed over the years, so the boxes from the 90s may be different than the boxes from the 2000s. But what they would do is they would go into other boxes or bins that contained evidence from a case. So there might be a box with rape evidence in it. There may also be a paper bag that contained bed sheets or other evidence along with the case. And so they had to go through there, sort out the kits, and then figure out what things to send, because each case is individual. You know, we may view these all as thousands of boxes, but as the folks that work in the lab will tell you, you know, they read through a narrative of these cases and they figure out what to test based on what the report was. So maybe in one certain case it might be really important to test a bed sheet. In another case it may not be really important to do that. So it wasn't, you know, we call it the forklift approach of testing all kits, but really it's far more individualized than that. There may have been other places in Ohio where kits were stored differently, where they were stored in places that were maybe not as dry as they should be or as temperature controlled or where they were damp or things like that, that there could have been problems that caused some of that degradation that we talked about. But in Cleveland, at least as far as I know, that wasn't a huge issue.
Brian in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Brian.
Hi there. I had a question about the rape kits. Are they specific to gender? Is there a male and a female? If you have a male or a female victim, is there a specific rape kit or is it generic? And also kind of on the same thing, if you have a suspect, if a victim names someone as a suspect, is there some kind of a kit that's done to collect evidence from that person? And I'd be happy to take any answers off the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian. Good questions. Kristen Slaper?
Yes, so the kits are gender neutral. The paperwork that's associated with the kits is gender neutral, and we see kits both from male and female victims. What we encourage as part of the sexual assault response for the law enforcement is that they collect kits from suspects as well as from victims. For years, we have spent time focusing on victims. But what about evidence, DNA evidence that could be on a suspect's body?
And you could find evidence of the victim on their body.
Yes, absolutely. And we have many examples of that that we've seen.
Anna, as far as how those nurses are trained, sexual assault nurse examiners, not every nurse is trained in this way, right?
Right. Nurses usually apply to get in this training, which involves about 40 hours of didydactic training, which is in
what
a classroom, just a classroom training.
Okay.
And then there's 24 hours of clinical training where they work with live patient models. And so it's very specific. It's special training. And so that's where they learn not only about the scientific methods of collecting the evidence, but also of interacting with the victim, because the victim just went through something where their control and choice was taken away from them, which is a very traumatizing experience. So while the nurse has to collect this evidence, you still want to make sure you're checking in with the victim, making sure that what you're doing is okay and that they are really leading the exam. So
in the process of the exam, one of the extremes you can go to is to take off all of your clothes on top of a large white sheet, right? Something like that?
That can happen. It's really just what's most comfortable for the victim.
Well, that's what I mean, though. I mean,
right.
How often do people actually do that? Because it would be hard to do it under any circumstances, let alone after you've been raped.
Right. Usually it's about, you know, they just go one area of the body at a time, saving usually the last when you're down in the genital area. And it's a very private and can be re-traumatizing for the victim. But you don't have to necessarily get all the way unclothed. And the nurses are really sensitive to all of this. So, I mean, they make sure to ensure your privacy, let them know it's just me, you know, here. And they're really narrating everything they're doing.
Have male and females been trained as sexual assault nurse examiners?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. But not necessarily in any given hospital, particularly in rural areas. Are they staffed with kind of people that have been trained that way?
Right. Correct. So I can only speak to Ohio Health.
Uh-huh.
We have four Central Ohio coordinators, sexual assault nurse examiner coordinators who coordinate the sexual assault care. And then we have one regional coordinator for hospitals in Mansfield. But so I can't speak to the rural areas as much. But it's true that some do not have any of these nurses who are specially trained. So what happens is just any medical professional can take the evidence. But unfortunately, the quality of the evidence might not be as good. And also just interaction with the victim can be a little bit more precarious, probably.
I will say that one of the things is with the group that I'm a part of, the state sexual assault response training team, what we found in various communities that have a sexual assault SART, that's what we nickname them. It's a multi-pronged approach to a response. So there's an advocate involved, law enforcement, prosecutor, and the nurse. And everybody works together. Everybody understands each other's roles so that the response for that survivor, that patient, that victim is much more multifaceted, and they can have the necessary things that they need in order to respond to their case. So the lab's been recently brought into that, and part of the training team is we're going to the rural areas in the state of Ohio to kind of preach about, you know, mm-hmm. the best way to respond to these types of cases. And there are smaller hospitals that are trying to set up SANE programs and bring a SANE in.
Getting back to the question that the caller had about suspects, you said that you encourage law enforcement to use rape kits on the suspects as well. So they'd be using the same kit.
Typically, the law enforcement agency would be responsible for collecting that themselves.
Yeah, and I'm wondering how well trained they are.
Right. That's another training aspect.
And there's also a legal aspect of consent. You know, someone would have to consent to having that, you know, evidence collected from them as well. I think what it really depends on probably is the investigation, the type of investigation, the report. Right. What I see more often is law enforcement asking someone just to collect their DNA swab, just so that they have that person's DNA for comparison. But even that, someone could say, you know, no, thank you, I don't want to do that. And then they would have to get a search warrant to do that. So I think part of the reason we haven't seen that more yet is because it is a little bit legally tricky. You know, you'd have to have someone really knowingly and voluntarily allowing that to be collected, and then there'd be questions about whether they understood what it would be used for and stuff like that. So I think there'd have to be a whole thoughtful process to standardize that statewide, just like, you know, collecting kits from victims has been standardized as much as possible.
You know, Rachel DeSalle, I wanted to drill down a little bit into an issue that we haven't touched on really, and that is when somebody reports a rape, they may go through the whole rape kit process or part of it or whatever they decide to do or whatever they need to do on that score, but that law enforcement for a long time discriminated. They didn't necessarily follow through on the rape kits because the person reporting the rape was maybe a sex worker, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of the story is definitely very complicated. You know, people in law enforcement, just like people in every walk of life, you know, come to work with biases. And they also, you know, for many years, I think law enforcement didn't get the training that they deserve to be working these very tough types of cases. And so, you know, when you would talk to people that worked in sex crimes 20 years ago, you'd often hear, you know, this is just another he said, she said case. So, you know, I wasn't really going to be hunting down the victim. I also heard a lot of, you know, detectives that very honestly said, you know, when I have a huge caseload and I have to choose between investigating a case of someone accused of raping a 3-year-old and, you know, somebody who may have been a sex worker or a drug addict and doesn't really want to cooperate with me, I'm going to choose the child. And so people were very honest about why they were making the decisions they were making. You know, and that's not saying that those decisions are right or wrong, but I think in our reporting, we were really trying to understand why things like that happened. And what I've seen is the more that officers get training on what that trauma looks like after a rape and how people may respond, especially in ways that may seem odd to you if you're an investigator, but if you understand what happened to them and how their body and their brain might react, they make a little bit more sense. And then you also learn how to interview and, you know, talk to someone in a more supportive way. You know, if you were to read police reports from 20 years ago, there were countless reports in Cleveland that described what the victim was wearing before there was a single word about what the victim said or what the victim was doing. You know, were they using drugs? Were they, you know, on the streets or whatever? And so when investigations were starting at that point, it's no wonder that a lot of victims disengaged from that system, because if the first contact you have is with someone who's questioning everything that you did and not what someone else did to you, you may choose not to come back in for a second interview. And I think that's where a lot of those cases were lost. And once that person didn't come back in, the law enforcement agency probably did decide not to test that kid. Now we know better than that.
Anna Thompson, is there any evidence that how you manage the investigation at that very front and on the front lines in the hospital matters going down the road?
Well, I don't know if I can speak to specific evidence, but I think, yes, that immediate response is extremely important. And a supportive response is the difference between a victim staying and plugged in with the investigation or not. Just because, I mean, if the victim's not involved, like Rachel is saying, they might just drop the case because, I mean, they need the victim's involvement to gather evidence. So right after a trauma like that, your brain goes through a reaction that releases all these different hormones. And depending on which hormones are released, it kind of informs your reaction. And so it's important for the people working with the victim to understand that this victim is really happy and laughing. Well, there's reasons behind that. It's not a reason to disbelieve them. It's kind of what their body's doing right now to survive through this moment and the immediate aftermath. So that support and proper interaction right after, I think, is really important.
You know, I'm going to talk with Christian Slaper about how they do this, how they notify victims years later once the rape kit's being analyzed, after it's been analyzed. But Anna Thompson, I have to let you go. And before I do, I want to ask you, what's your recommendation for labs, for law enforcement, when they're notifying someone who's just completely been out of it, you know, been out of the process for 10, 15 years sometimes? What is it like to be suddenly notified that there's a suspect has been identified because they finally processed the kit?
So my recommendation number one is to bring an advocate with you. I'm an advocate, and we're trained to work with survivors and kind of give them that choice and power back. So if you're coming to a victim 20 years later, they might have not have thought about that assault for 20 years.
Right.
Just they've probably moved on with their life. So to be confronted with that again 20 years later, there's going to be maybe even another trauma reaction, flashbacks, just a lot of pain coming back from that. So my recommendation is, along with notifying them, bring an advocate who can talk to them and offer resources to that person to kind of deal with what's going on and get help they need throughout this process. So.
Well, Anna Thompson, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Anna Thompson is the Aftercare Advocacy and Outreach Coordinator at Sexual Assault Response Network of Central Ohio at Ohio Health. We'll continue our conversation again. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the importance of rape kits in identifying and prosecuting rapists in the United States. For decades, a backlog of untested rape kits built up across the country. That's changing, including in Ohio, which is now considered a model state with its 2014 law requiring police to test all old and current rape kits. Still with us is Cleveland Plain Dealer reporter Rachel DeSalle. She's been investigating the backlog of rape kits in Ohio since 2009. Also with us, forensic scientist and laboratory supervisor for the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation, Kristen Slaper. And joining us now is the Bureau of Criminal Investigations Assistant Superintendent, Karen Huey. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan.
How does the Bureau of Criminal Investigation test rape kits? You had this, I guess, kind of an onslaught come in, Karen Huey. What was the process for sorting it all out?
Correct. Attorney General DeWine developed a consortium to look at all these untested kits, and they came up with a number of recommendations back in 2011. But basically, he put out the call to all law enforcement, we will test all kits. So he asked law enforcement agencies to go back, go through their evidence rooms, bring in all those old untested kits. We added about 10 DNA scientists to our staff that would be focused on SAK testing. And we added additional equipment. So we upgraded, purchased robotics, so to speed up our DNA processing system. In addition to that, we also worked on our procedures. Instead of doing some pre-testing, some pre-analysis on DNA kits, we just took that forklift approach that you heard about. Everything comes in, everything gets tested. Law enforcement regularly calls us and says, is this a kit I should submit? And we tell them to submit it. We'll take all kits.
And how many came in?
We have collected over 14,000 SAK kits, and we've tested about 90% of those.
And there's also a process by which, as they accumulate in departments going forward, they need to be sent in within a certain amount of time.
Absolutely. House Bill 316 requires kits to be submitted within 30 days.
How much does it cost now? There was a cost-saving piece of this. Mm-hmm. How much did it cost back in the 90s, and what's changed?
I don't have an answer as to how much it cost then. I'm not sure we did the analysis.
Uh-huh.
As we improved our procedures and everything, it's a little bit above $400 per kit. And that is for the time, the consumables, the things that we used for the DNA analysis.
Okay. So that's pretty much what you said, Rachel DeSalle, earlier, right?
Correct. And I think, too, it's important to note that, just testing that kit initially is just the first step in the process. And a lot of the cases I followed, investigators will go back and review these files, and then they may go back to the lab and say, hey, there's this other piece of evidence. Will you guys test this for us? Or there's a dispute about this, so can you test this other piece of evidence or do a second test for us or whatever? So the lab then does have other work that it has to do. It doesn't just kind of test the kit and then it's over. They continue to work with investigators all the way up until, a case is either resolved or goes to trial.
Well, what happens? So then you get the rape kit tested, mm-hmm. At the Attorney General, in the BCI, and then you report back to the local law enforcement agency. And is there an imperative that they do anything with that?
It is up to the individual agency. I can tell you the Cuyahoga County Task Force that BCI participates on is probably the best role model as to what to do with investigating these rape kits. One of their pillars is to investigate all kits. So whether or not it's a positive or a negative coming back from the kit. So as Rachel was indicating, if you get a negative response, so there's not any DNA in the kit, they're going to go back to that case and they're going to see, is there additional evidence here? They're going to look at the facts. Are there additional bed sheets or clothing or something secondary that we can submit to help evaluate that case?
But there's no law.
No.
Requiring
no,
that.
No, that would be up to the individual investigators. But again, I think in talking about the task force, they've really come up with some best practices. Sort of four pillars have arisen from the task force in the sense of that they put out test all kits. So they continually, that's the motto they chose, and that's what they tell other law enforcement to do, as they're advising or giving advice on how to set up a task force. Swab all felony arrestees. I mean, that's critical that we get all of the felony arrestees into the CODIS database. I know it was mentioned earlier.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, though, because in preparing for this, I saw that there is a that there's been an interesting effect from that people have said, told law enforcement agencies that they don't commit subsequent crimes because they know their DNA is now in, not, I'm not saying universally they do this, but some have said they don't, it has affected their crime fighting, they don't commit crimes afterward because they know their DNA is now in the system.
I don't know that to be true. Obviously, we have people that commit crimes. We have hits in our CODIS database daily.
Exactly.
I don't know that to be true.
Okay.
I don't know if anyone else has
Rachel
a comment.
Rachel DeSalle?
Yeah, I don't know that there's been any research on that. I think what investigators have heard anecdotally is someone saying, you know, I was trying not to get my DNA collected so that this didn't hit to me. And there is some evidence that even though Ohio has a separate law that requires DNA collected from anyone arrested for a felony, that does not happen all the time as it should. And so if it did, there probably would be more cases solved. So that's just, you know, another area to work on. And I know that there's been a lot of effort put into creating ways that departments can go in and make sure that they're collecting all the DNA that they should.
How do you log the information compared to 15 or 20 years ago, Kristen?
As far as logging the rape kit information and we have a laboratory information management system, and that's how we keep track of all of the cases that we work. It's a computerized system that basically keeps track of what was in the case and what happened, what we found in the kit and all of that. So it's electronic. As far as logging the kits that are collected, mm-hmm. that's a different subject and discussion. As far as, the Attorney General's office knows how many kits are collected because we reimburse the hospitals for those kits being tested or being submitted. But keeping track of how many are collected versus how many are submitted is a bit of a different issue.
Yeah. One other thing I wanted to bring up, because I think this is, you know, we often talk a lot about investigations and the lab staff doesn't get, credit for some of the things that they've done. You know, we've had investigations in Cuyahoga County that the lab has worked on that has really kind of busted myths and solved cases that wouldn't have otherwise been solved because they would have been difficult. There's always a thought that in the past, which is changing now, that if a case is one where the victim and the perpetrator know each other, that the DNA doesn't matter. So law enforcement would think, you know, if both parties agree something happened and there's a reason for DNA to be there, then we don't need to test a kit because that's a non-issue. And there have been at least a couple cases I can think of in Cuyahoga County where the lab staff actually was able to come back and say, you know, we read this report, you read this report, and this DNA, where it is at, where we collected, you know, the sample from this swab, from this person's body and where we tested it, it's in a completely different place. It does not make sense with what the suspect's statement was. You know, the suspect said, this is what happened. The victim said, this is what happened. And the DNA proves what the victim said was correct. So it's really changed that part of the investigation as well and changed the minds, you know, of a lot of investigators I have talked to as to how to use that tool and kind of how to work with the lab, not just to say, you know, yes, this is our suspect, but to say, what's the truth here of what happened and how can the DNA help prove it?
Linda in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Go ahead.
It is my understanding that the cities can hold back 20% of their rape kits. I'm wondering, why is that?
Where do you get your understanding from? Why? What do you?
I saw a couple years ago in the media, and I'm going to say that I heard it on the radio, that there was a report that someone had told them that cities had the option of holding back 20% of the rape kit.
I wonder why they would do that. That's, as far as you know, Karen Huey?
No, I'm not aware of that.
Because are the cities paying for the processing?
It depends. If they're submitting to BCI, we don't charge for our DNA analysis, so that's free. Some of the larger urban departments have their own crime labs, so obviously those are paid and subsidized by the city of Columbus or city of Cincinnati or the county. But I am not aware of that 20%.
Okay. All right, Linda. Thanks. Not all rape kits lead to prosecution. What do you do with all of these materials after they've been processed? Kristen Slee?
The materials themselves get returned to the department. So it's up to the department to store those materials. However, the DNA profiles that get generated, the notes, anything like that are provided. You know, we provide reports as to our findings to the law enforcement agencies and to the prosecutor's offices in every case.
Yeah. And then is there any regulation about how local law enforcement agencies are supposed to store those going forward?
Well, I think most law enforcement agencies have evidence storage policies and procedures. They should be temperature controlled. They should be secure. There's always a lot of safety and security surrounding evidence protocols. So that would be the case. Whether or not that happens across the state, it's hard to say.
You know, Karen Huey, is there any number you can put on how much the Ohio Attorney General's office has invested in this process since 2014?
We have probably spent $4 to $5 million, I would say, in working the SAK initiative, whether that's hiring personnel, equipment. We also have dedicated 3 BCI agents and a supervisor and an intelligence analyst to the Cuyahoga County Task Force. So we've been embedded in that task force since its inception. And up to update Rachel, they just indicted their 600th individual up there. So they've had a lot of success.
Go ahead.
I wanted to mention one other thing. You were talking about sort of the victim-centered approach, and that's something that task force very much adopted. So when they're going out to talk to a victim for the first time, it's always a victim advocate and an investigator together. Because I think, you know, the folks already that have been speaking have mentioned that, you know, you're going back to a victim that it may have been 10 years ago. So, you know, there's a lot of effort and work not to re-traumatize that victim, but again, to sort of open the door and indicate that, you know, a prosecution might be possible, but we're going to need more information going forward. But they, you know, the victim advocate stays with them all throughout that process. They're there through the prosecution. It's an opportunity to provide victim services to a victim that may not have received those.
We have an email from Laura. She writes, I was raped in 1986. The Columbus Police Department has told me that they no longer have the rape kit. In the police report, they did say they found spermatozoa. Can your guest talk about police policies for saving these kits from decades before, if you have not already talked about that? I mean, is there any protocol for once a kit's been put together? Can you just get rid of it if you feel like it?
Individual agencies are going to have their own retention policies. I think with Cuyahoga County, obviously, they kept everything forever, so it's really paid off up there. But it would depend on the individual agency what their retention policy was.
The Ohio Supreme Court ruled in a case related to the delayed reaction of getting rape kits tested. A suspect wasn't charged with rape until 20 years later when the kit was tested. What was the ruling and what's the significance, Rachel DeSalle?
Well, there's a couple of different rulings, so I'm not clear on which one that you're talking about.
Okay. There was one in August, I think, and another one in a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
I thought, but go ahead.
I'd have to know exactly which one you were talking about because there's been 3 different ones.
Okay.
But, you know, there's been one ruling that says that, you know, just the delay in time alone does not mean that you can't go forward with a case. That there's got to be other factors involved that would basically show that it's so unfair to someone that they, you know, can't find any witnesses. No, you know, all the witnesses are dead. Most of the evidence is gone. That they can't fairly defend themselves. There was another ruling that looked at specifically people who were juveniles at the time of their offense and whether it is appropriate now, years later, to prosecute them as adults. And in that particular case, the answer was, you know, no, you know, that's not appropriate to do. So there's been a number of rulings in a couple different ways, mostly based on kind of some very specific cases. But on the whole, the cases have been deemed prosecutable.
Rachel DeSalle, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Rachel DeSalle, reporter for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, spent the last 7 years investigating overlooked rape kits in Ohio. Also, Karen Huey, Bureau of Criminal Investigations Assistant Superintendent. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Kristen Slaper, Laboratory Supervisor for the Ohio Attorney General's Bureau of Criminal Investigation Laboratory. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Ann.
The Sexual Assault Response Network of Central Ohio's 24-hour rape crisis helpline is 614-267-7020. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.